Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Brown, who is currently investigative reporter for the Associated Press and was previously national security editor for the Associated Press. He is the co-author, along with Douglas Farrar, of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot, Merchants of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Made War Possible. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Brown.
Thanks, Ian.
And obviously, there's a lot of arms are about to pour into Syria. There's been a reluctance on the part of the West to supply arms to the rebels, but now the EU have voted, contentious vote nonetheless, have voted to allow the ban on the on export to the rebels to expire on Saturday. This has prompted the Russians to send warnings that they're going to send S-300 ground-to-air missiles, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia saying that this would be a stabilizing factor that could dissuade some hotheads from entering the conflict, referring to the EU. So it looks like there's an arms race underway.
Well, possibly. I mean, remember that Russia has been very careful when there have been several attempts in the UN over the last few years to install an arms embargo against the Syrian government. You know, the Russians have stepped in and basically, you know, made sure that the Security Council couldn't do that. So they, you know, they've sort of tipped their hand, you know, even before this, that they were going to make sure that their strong client, which was the Syrian government, was protected. And in this case, you know, it's sort of an extension of that policy. They're now saying, if arms start to flow to the rebels, then they'll simply pour in more to the Syrian government.
But there's a further complication to this, and that is that the Israeli defense minister said that, talking about the S-300s, the shipments haven't set out yet, and I hope they won't, said Moshe Yalon, the deputy, the Israel's defense minister. But he continued saying, but if they do arrive in Syria, God forbid, we'll know what to do. So you could have the Russians and the Israelis duking it out, could you not?
Well, I mean, I suppose conceivably, but it's highly remote. I mean, in essence, what the Israelis are trying to do here is maintain their air superiority, which obviously showed recently when they went after sites near Damascus. But, you know, I think before the Syrians tangled with the Russian government, I think we would see some folks stepping back. It's hard to imagine that getting to that extreme.
Well, of course, they're supposed to be having a peace talk, which was arranged, I believe, because there's a personal connection between the Foreign Minister Lavrov and the new Secretary of State, John Kerry. Kerry was able to persuade the Russians to join in a peace talks that will take place in Geneva. But now you have all this jockeying over the arms. It doesn't sound like peace is in the wind. It sounds more like war's in the wind.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm more conversant in the arms side of this this situation than the diplomatic side. I think we've got a long way to go. Everybody's talking. So at this stage, I think you know, the arms sales are, you know, they're the newest flavor here, but it remains to be seen where this heads.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Brown, who's currently investigative reporter for the Associated Press and was previously the national security editor for the AP, and he is co-author, along with Douglas Farrar, of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot, Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Made War Possible. So if indeed the Russians are sincere about trying to bring about a diplomatic solution, and as they have expressed many times, they have genuine concerns about the nature of the Syrian opposition, particularly the more radical groups, al-Nusra, who appear to dominate the opposition, being Sunni jihadists who would inspire jihad in the Russian Caucasus, where, of course, recently we became aware of that because of the Boston bombers. So they have some fairly, I think, credible arguments about the nature of the Syrian opposition. But at the same time, one is sort of suspicious and somewhat skeptical of Russia's motives. I believe that one in five Russian industrial workers is in the arms business, and Syria is a huge arms client. So how much are Putin and company in this for the money and to hold on to their naval base in Tartus?
Well, I mean, unlike some of their main competitors, I mean, the you know, United States being a pretty strong example, I mean, the Russian government has continued to boost its arms exports in recent years. But one thing you also have to remember is that the bulk of the money that Russia is spending these days on defense is spending on, you know, basically repairing its own very, very tattered arms inventory. They let everything from planes to new weaponry slide, and so most of their money has been going into boosting their own armies stocks. But I mean, Syria is clearly a strong client. There are other places where they're hoping to make inroads, Africa, Latin America. But the loss of Syria would put a dent into their arms sales. But they are already casting about and have been in recent last few years to try to open up a new entree elsewhere, just in case things like this happen. So they've been working hard with India, for example. They still have a certain amount of sales in China that they're still a big client. So, you know, a loss of Syria would hurt, but it wouldn't kill off the Russian arms export industry by any case.
And how much does Putin control things? I mean, he is often, you know, Russia's often referred to as KGB Incorporated under Putin, whose cronies seem to be throughout the Kremlin, and he seems to be in many ways the sort of the boss of the bosses, if you will, regulating organized crime, if you will. So has the freewheeling days of under Yeltsin, when overnight billionaires were plundering state assets and people like Victor Boot were able to get his hands on this vast inventory of arms, are those days over?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's starting in 2000. You know, Boot consolidated the various top arms exporters into one, and he maintains a very tight rein over that operation. Even Boot, when he was nabbed by the U.S. in 2008, it's very interesting. Prosecutors were very, very careful not to show him as an agent of the Russian government, but the top informant in that case talked about meeting Boot at a major military industrial building in Moscow. So it was sort of implied, but never stated overtly. But in essence, Boot had been reeled back too by 2008. So it's different than it was in the 60s. It's not the sort of the ideological backed pipelines that we saw back then, basically used to foment revolution around the globe. This time, it's basically to bring money back into Russian coffers. But they're trying to revive some of those pipelines, and they're trying to get new clients. But all of that is being largely directed out of Moscow and through the military complex there.
And when the DEA nabbed Boot in Thailand, I believe, the Russians protested, saying that the U.S. is operating on a double standard, that they were selling arms all around the world, and this was hypocrisy. Did they have a case here? I mean, and why was the DEA involved?
Well, I mean, they did somewhat. I mean, in essence, you know, the Russians could say, well, you know, here is a guy who is essentially our proxy, and you know, you nabbed him while he was, you know, doing our government's will, but they weren't willing to say that publicly. So they couldn't make that argument unless they were willing to acknowledge that he was working for them, which they couldn't do. And there was always sort of a gray area about how much they were willing to say, and indeed how much rope they were willing to give him. But as long as, you know, both of the goals of Boot and the Russian government went in the same direction, they were, you know, they allowed him to do what they needed to do. So, yeah, there was a certain amount of hypocrisy. They could have made that argument, but they, in essence, weren't willing to do so because it would have, you know, it meant acknowledging what he was doing. There's a new new potential case on the horizon that could affect some of that, and where some of this may come into daylight. Boot's right-hand man, a guy by the name of Richard Cicciocli, just was extradited last weekend to New York, and he's going to be facing charges related to Boot's arrest back in 2008. If Cicciocli testifies for the government, if he turns state witness, if you will, that could provide a whole new slew of details.
And he's a Russian citizen, right? And where did they extradite him from?
Yeah, he was in Moscow, but when Boot was arrested, he, for some inexplicable reason, decided to surreptitiously go to Australia, where he ran a carpet business for a while, but then eventually tried to get a job with the police force in Victoria. And they caught him, they checked his fingerprints, and so he was arrested. So, he was Boot's right-hand man. He knew everything about the operation. And, that should be an interesting trial.
It should be an interesting trial, but it also makes you wonder whether he was the brightest bulb in the...
Are we talking about this fellow, or are we talking about Boot?
Well, no, I'm talking about this guy. If he wanted to be a cop, he must have known that they would have done a fingerprint check.
He's a strange character, but apparently he's a wizard at all kinds of financial ledger domain, particularly in putting together shell companies. So, as unhinged as he might have been, he did have his uses.
So, again, what has Putin done then to rein this in? He doesn't use these cutouts like Boot as front man.
It's much more like our operation. I mean, for example, there's a lot more transparency today than existed in the 60s. In the 60s, we had no idea. The Russians never told us, you know, directly who their clients were or how much they were sending to them. These days, there are all sorts of analysts, Russian analysts, who talk about it, and all those figures are available if you go if you start searching the web. So you have to give them that. It's not being done in the dark. But at the same time, particularly when you talk about very sensitive clients like Iran or Syria, back during the days when Gaddafi ran things in Libya, not everything is done overtly. And if they want to, you know, make a deal for a particular sensitive armament, or, for example, surface-to-air missiles, they may not announce that, or they may, it may be done in the details may not be as overt as the United States might suggest. So that's where somebody like Boot can and at times did play a role, or if they're selling to Hezbollah, for example, or the Iranians. It depends on the client, and it depends on the circumstances.
But in terms of the Iranians now, the Russians have shown some restraint with these same missiles that they're sending or threatening to send to Syria, the S-300s, which Israel is basically saying if they go to Syria, as far as we're concerned, they'll end up in Hezbollah's arms and they're fair game for us. The Iranians wanted the S-300s as a deterrent against an Israeli strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Russia I believe the West twisted Putin's arm a bit on that. And they haven't delivered them, have they? And they haven't delivered them to Syria yet, so...
No. But at the same time, you know, the Russians also have talked about giving the S-300s to Turkey and to doing some mutual defense work there. So the Israelis haven't, as far as I know, haven't made a peep about that. So, again, I mean, all of this depends on the circumstances and... there's a certain amount of gamesmanship. It remains to be seen whether the Russians are going to actually go forward with that. It's one thing to talk about it and to essentially potentially give Assad a bluff. The question is, are they going to deliver? All of that, it still remains to be seen here. I don't think we've suddenly, rushed. At least it would be hard to say at this point that things have reached a more dire episode than they've been in recent weeks. There's a lot of talk here, but
the ship hasn't sailed, right?
Not yet.
Yeah. So, but in terms of Russia's, responsibility, if there's such a thing in the arms world, showing some restraint, responsibility, most of what they transfer is light arms and, pretty much Cold War stuff. I mean, these new missiles are fairly advanced because, for example, we transfer a lot of stuff to Israel, and the Israelis have a massive arms industry. And they then turn around and sell a lot of stuff to China, which irritates the U.S. because they upgraded China's air force and upgraded their entire inventory of tanks, for example. So what kind of restraint, again, do they show in terms of really upgrading potential adversaries around the world?
We're talking about the Russians?
Yeah.
Again, I think it depends on the case. If it got to the point where we felt, where the United States government felt that they were tipping, a particular situation into one that was particularly dangerous, i.e., what we're talking about in Syria, I think you'd see a lot of diplomatic maneuvering before we got to that point. And I don't see that at this stage. Obviously the very fact that Lavrov and Kerry continue to negotiate shows that it's one thing to raise that possibility, but I don't think we're anywhere near that point yet. I don't see any evidence.
Right. Well, but when you mentioned the guy down in Australia who was Boots' right-hand man, the idea that he was a carpet salesman and was looking for a job would indicate to me that there may be a lot of these Russians wandering around the world that have tremendous amount of arms knowledge and perhaps even weapons of mass destruction knowledge. Are there a lot of them on the loose?
Well, there are always little cases that pop up in Eastern Europe of folks with, there have been a number of these cases where folks pop up with a certain amount of, I don't know if you call it WMD, but you know, there's a certain amount of radioactive material in hand. Although obviously that's a continuing concern of the U.S. and folks have raised this, repeatedly with the possibility of this material getting into the hands of an Al Qaeda or an Al Qaeda like, a terror organization. Here it is. It's we've known that Al Qaeda has been after this material since at least 2002. It's now 2013, and we still have yet to see any, case where they clearly have been able to, to get this material, number one, and then use it. So I think the international efforts, as far as I can tell, have been pretty robust, and their track record speaks for itself.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Brown, were you one of the AP reporters that phones were tapped? I mean, I know you're no longer the national security editor at the Associated Press, which would make you a prime target for the Justice
Right.
Department's
Right.
sweeping wiretaps. But were you caught up in that?
No, my phones were not the target of any of these, as far as I know.
Right, but you must have
as I know.
Right, but you must have an opinion on it. It's happened to your colleagues.
Oh, I might, but that's for AP's management to talk about.
Okay. I'm assuming you're not happy about it. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Brown.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Stephen Brown, who's currently the investigative reporter for the Associated Press. He was formerly the national security editor for the AP and a former national correspondent based in Washington for the Los Angeles Times. He shared the Times' 1991 Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the Los Angeles riots and is the co-author, along with Douglas Farrar, of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot, Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Made War Possible. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.